Dan's laughter died soon enough.
"I don't see anything funny about this situation," Jane said coldly.
Wiping at his eyes, Dan replied, "When they hand you a lemon, make lemonade."
"What?"
Gesturing to the moonlit beach and the star-filled sky, he said, "Here we are, alone on a tropical island, far away from the rest of the crazy world. Let's make the most of it."
Her nostrils flared angrily. "Is that all you can think of?"
He quoted, "Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy nor love nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain."
Jane got to her feet so quickly that her chair fell over behind her. "Vasily Malik will be here tomorrow to explain the fine details of the confiscation procedures."
"Great," said Dan, grinning ruefully up at her.
"You will remain incommunicado on this island until the Council deems it proper for you to be released."
"Released? To where? Debtor's prison? Or will the Council send me to Malik's gulag up at Aristarchus?"
Jane huffed at him, turned on her heel, and walked away so fast that she was almost running.
"Go on," Dan called after her silently. "Run away. You can run, gorgeous, but you can't hide."
Then he waved at one of the waiters who had been hovering off at the edge of the patio. The young man came over and picked up Jane's chair, then asked,
"Sir?" "The best bottle of Armagnac you've got," Dan ordered. "And a large snifter."
"Armagnac?"
The kid's brow furrowed.
"I don't know if we have—"
"You've got it. Just ask the bartender."
2 minutes later, the youngster came back with a green bottle shaped like a flat canteen and a snifter big enough to keep goldfish in. Dan smiled and poured for himself. The waiter retreated back to the shadows. Holding his glass high, pointing it in the direction that Jane had taken, Dan finished his quotation aloud.
"And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night."
Then he laughed softly to himself.
"But we're going to clash in broad daylight, Malik and me. Tomorrow."
He awoke with the sun, and a thundering headache.
"Too much of a good thing," Dan grumbled to himself as he squinted blearily at the morning brightness. "Armagnac goes down smooth, but leaves a reminder the next day."
"Or maybe you're just getting old, pal."
"Seems to me you could drink a whole flagon of the stuff without a twinge way back when."
Like all the rooms of the hotel, his hut consisted of a thatched roof and bamboo screening that reached neither the ground nor the roof. Most of the insects native to the island had been eliminated by biogenetic controls. But Dan still was not happy about the sand that inevitably seeped onto the floor matting. Shrugging, he padded naked to the bathroom, took one bleary look at himself in the mirror, and decided that corrective action had to be taken right away. Still naked, he walked out of the hut, away from the hotel's office and restaurant, toward the lagoon. He splashed into the water. It was not as warm as he had expected, but that didn't matter. He dove in, came up sputtering and spouting, then began methodically swimming parallel to the beach. He reached the channel between islets, felt the current rushing outward, and reversed his course. By the time he got back to where he had started, one of the hotel's boys was standing ankle-deep in the water, patiently holding a towel for him. Dan came out of the lagoon and wrapped the towel around his middle. He was puffing like an old man. Swimming was a new sport to him. He had never had the opportunity to do much of it back in the days when he lived in orbital space, and somehow when he was on Earth he was always too busy to take the time to paddle around in a pool. It was only a year earlier that he had finally allowed himself to order a swimming pool built into his quarters at Alphonse's. It had taken a real effort of mind to convince himself that water, manufactured from lunar oxygen baked out of rocks and hydrogen scooped up in the regolith, was no longer as rare on the moon as it had once been. It took a lot of energy to produce water, which made it very expensive. But once Dan realized with a happy surprise that he could easily afford 100 swimming pools, he had his own private one built. As he started back toward his hut, he could feel the tropical sun baking him dry. He asked the young man walking slightly behind him, "Is there a plane scheduled to come in today?" "I don't know. I can check.
Yeah, please do. I'll be going to the patio for breakfast.
Yes, sir.
By the time he had finished a large glass of orange juice, the youngster came back to report that a plane was indeed due to land shortly after noon. Dan thanked him, then started in on his breakfast of ham and eggs. The hotel kept its livestock on one of the islets on the other side of the lagoon. Even when the wind blew from that direction, the isle was far enough away so that the smell did not bother the guests.
What guests? Dan thought sourly as he ate.
This operation can't be making a profit with only two people here. The double-dam GEC won't pay enough to break even. Those bureaucrats don't believe in making profits, just in getting all the privileges of living like millionaires for themselves.
Jane stayed in her hut all morning and refused to answer his phone calls. He was supposed to be kept incommunicado from the rest of the world, so Dan did not even bother to try contacting his offices. He took out one of the outrigger canoes, paddled around the lagoon, visited the pigs and chickens on the farthest islet, and managed to overturn the outrigger in the current between islands to the uproarious delight of the Polynesian staff of the hotel, who apparently had nothing better to do than watch him from the beach. Standing in 4 feet of sun-warmed water, Dan righted the canoe, tilted it to drain the water from inside it, and then rowed with as much dignity as he could muster back to the hotel's beach. He had to grin to himself, though. Overturning an outrigger must be a rare sight to these kids. Dan was lying on the beach, letting the sun dry him and his swim trunks, when Malik's plane made its appearance. At first it was only a barely visible dot in the bright blue sky, a foreign intruder in paradise. Then it came lower, grew into a dark, swept-wing shape, shrieking like a turbine-powered banshee, and finally settled onto the ground, flaps dangling down, wheels kicking up coral dust when they touched the runway. He watched Jane go across the bridge in the electric cart, and a few minutes later came back again with Vasily Malik sitting beside her. Dan smiled to himself at Malik's light blonde hair and pale pink skin. Maybe he'll get sunstroke, he thought happily. The ozone layer was so damaged that you could get skin cancer from solar ultraviolet if you weren't careful. But Dan found that he could not wish cancer on Malik. Not that. Not even for him. As he got to his feet and brushed the sand off, he saw the cart go back across the bridge again. The plane's staying, Dan realized. Malik's planning to leave after he has the chance to gloat over me. With a grin, he wondered what Malik would do if he swam out to the plane and took off in it. No, Dan muttered to himself. The son of a bitch would probably order the peacekeepers to shoot me down. He'd tell them I'm a terrorist on my way to nuke the Vatican. So he walked slowly toward the patio dining area. Sure enough, Malik and Jane were sitting at a table shaded by a broad, gaily striped umbrella, their heads together like a pair of conspirators.
What a surprise!
Dan shouted as he stepped onto the ironwood-floored patio.
Vasily! You've flown all the way from Paris just to see me. I'm honored.
Malik returned his smile.
I wouldn't have missed this occasion for the world, he said.
Jane looked just as edgy as she had the night before. Maybe more so, thought Dan. She was wearing a dark blue pair of shorts and a sleeveless white blouse. Dark glasses were her only concession to the hot tropical sun overhead. She tans well, Dan remembered, hoping that she was smart enough to use sunblock anyway. Malik always seemed to have precisely the correct wardrobe for every occasion. He looked as if he had just stepped out of a video advertisement. Casual whipcord slacks of light tan, an ivory-colored short-sleeved shirt with blue-tabbed epaulettes, and a woven straw hat with a snap brim slanted at a rakish angle. No sunglasses, but his icy blue eyes looked darker than usual. Contact lenses, Dan concluded. He's too damned conceited even to wear sunglasses. In nothing but his swim trunks and an unbuttoned open weave shirt, Dan pulled up a chair and joined them in the shade of the umbrella.
So tell me, he said cheerfully to Malik, how busy you're going to make my lawyers.
Malik gave him a smile full of teeth.
Your lawyers can become as busy as they like. There is no way for them to save you. You have clearly broken GEC regulations, which have the force of international law.
And just which regulations have I broken? Malik explained with great patience and obvious relish, citing specific clauses and dates.